From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Sonny Liston, heavyweight boxing champion in the early 1960s, died in 1971. The reason listed on the death certificate, natural causes. But nearly 50 years later, the question of whether he was murdered is an open one for some. It's a question Sean Assayle set out to answer with his book, The Murder of Sonny Liston, Las Vegas, Heroin, and Heavyweights. Lennon Lacey, a 17-year-old West Bladen High School football player, was found dead, hanging by belts from a swing set 4 years ago. Local authorities determined Lacey's death a suicide, but family members and the NAACP allege it was murder in the style of a lynching. Sean Assayle set out to investigate the story. 2 years after Lacey's death, the U.S. Justice Department issued its own determination, affirming the conclusion of local officials. Just last month, Glamour magazine published a story entitled "The Secret Fight to Save Confederate Monuments." The byline, Sean Assayle. There are a few threads here with which one could weave a theme, but we'll leave that bit of business to Sean Assayle himself, award-winning investigative journalist, reporter for ESPN for 20 years, author of 4 books, and a man who describes his instincts as always leading to crime and politics. Despite his 20 years in the investigations unit at ESPN, it's his job to tease out the conflict there, and he'll do that joining us now. Sean Assayle, welcome to Coastline.
I am thrilled to be here with you, Rachel. Thank you.
You're welcome. So glad to have you with us. And we're inviting you to join the conversation. Do you have questions about Sonny Liston or wonder what it's like to be an investigative reporter for one of the largest sports news organizations in the world, you can call us on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Sean Assayle, we're going to have a lot of listeners who have no idea who Sonny Liston was. So paint the picture of this formidable athlete at the peak of his success in the 1960s.
Well, you know, you want to go back to when being the heavyweight champion of the world was when sort of the giants roamed the earth, right? And it was more than just a sports figure. You know, Floyd Patterson was a breakthrough figure in the civil rights era. After Liston, you have Ali being the voice of the Vietnam generation. This was an era where you had Joe Louis in World War II, whose visage jumped out at you from recruitment stations. So these were more than just athletes. I mean, these were global political figures. Sonny Liston enters that era uneducated, ill-spoken, angry, raised by the mob in St. Louis. To do just one thing, which is hurt people. And he did it well. He did his job amazingly. He rockets to the heavyweight title by beating Floyd Patterson not once but twice, and then proceeds to lose that title to Ali, again, not once and then but twice. And the way he lost it, the way that he seemed to just want squander the great gifts that had been given to him led a lot of people to cry fix. By the time you meet him in my book, it's 4 years after his loss to Ali. He's in Vegas, and he's kind of settling into the seedy seams of the city.
And so what was it about Sonny Liston's death in the first place that made you want to investigate this and then write a book? Because even if this guy was murdered, he had entered this world like other characters in your book. You know, he lived on the seedy side of town. He committed his own criminal acts. He engaged in physical violence outside the ring. He used drugs. He sold drugs. It's no wonder he died under questionable circumstances, sort of like Irwin Peters. So why did you care?
Oh, what's not to love about what you just said? I mean, that's, you know, it's basically everybody I write about is like that. And, you know, what attracted me to the story was, and once I knew I wanted to write about Sonny, there were just too many good biographies to simply try to do another start-to-finish biography. So the idea was, let's set it in 1970 Las Vegas, where Las Vegas is an equal character, too. And it was just the most fun I've ever had writing a book. My wife went to the New York Public Library for a month until she looked at every issue of the Las Vegas Sun from 1970 until at dinner. It was like we were living in Vegas in the Strip at the time. Hey, honey, who do you want to see at the Stardust tonight? Louis Nye or you know, Benny Goodman? It was just wonderful. And part of doing that was I was able to draw some connections between Sonny, the mob, the Nation of Islam, just these disparate groups. What I didn't think when I was two-thirds of the way through was that I'd get that unmarked envelope that I got. Inside was a transcript of an interview with a police snitch, and that really propelled the book to new places.
Did your opinion of Sonny Liston change from the time you started work on the book till the time you finished it?
It certainly evolved. I mean, you know, there's the famous scene, a little bit overblown, but the famous scene where after he wins the title from Patterson, he flies to Philly where he was living at the time, expecting a parade. You know, nobody shows up and he's just mortally wounded. He wanted to be a gentleman champion like his idol Joe Louis. He never could. So, you know, he was born without a birth certificate, poor, in Forest City, Arkansas. And there's a theme to that, right, that he never knew who he was. It was said of him that if he won the title, it would fill a hole in him. He'd somehow discover himself. And he never did. And so that to me was both sympathetic and also frustrating, because he had all of these gifts and he had a lot that was given to him. And he never could really rise above the mobsters who raised him. And so, you know, he sort of died like the gangster he was born as.
As one of your wise former colleagues points out in an interview that he did with you about this book, The Murder of Sonny Liston, he points out that you answer the question of Sonny's death in the title. Why did you decide to do that? To you, it's not a question. To you, he was murdered.
Well, Rachel, I'm trying to sell books. No, but no. It is true that I felt at the end of my reporting that the preponderance of evidence suggested he was murdered. There are those that have thought that he died of a heroin overdose and that was it, plain and simple. Is it plausible? Sure. But I found with the number of people who wanted him dead and the amount of trouble he had gotten himself into, you know, keep in mind, there were a lot of people who thought that he took a dive against Ali to get a cut of Ali's future earnings. It's called the secret percentage theory. Ali was about to fight Joe Frazier for the largest purse ever. $5 million. Sonny wanted a cut of that. And he was making a lot of noise in Vegas at a time where, you know, a lot of people saw him as a has-been, and it would have been convenient for him to be dead. He was also working for a criminal gang run by a former band leader whose son told me that he did heroin with Sonny. Sonny had a junkie cocktail waitress on the side. I mean, you know, you go on and on, as I did, and there was a long list of people who wanted him dead, including, oddly enough, and what's great about Vegas is in a town of, you know, two or three acts a night, everybody was on their second and third lives, that, you know, a drug-dealing beautician who ran a place called Earl's Beauty Cage and, I'm told, had a contract out on Sonny because he thought Sonny set him up. So the deeper I went, and I turned myself into a cold case cop to do this, the more people I found just astoundingly had a reason to see that man under the ground.
You open the book with the death scene, and that's a scene that's just stuck with me since I first opened the book. Can you describe that scene?
It's at a chapel in Vegas. The Ink Spots are doing a rendition of Sonny. In the front row is, it's been a while since I wrote that, Doris Day, and I think Ed Sullivan is there, and all the big names show up, and all the little names. I mean, a documentary film producer was a boy at the time and remembers walking, you know, 20 blocks to be there. And Geraldine, his wife, who was always the dutiful wife, even as Sonny, you know, played around on her mercilessly, is there on the dais or on the stage. And at some point in the middle of all of this, with all of Las Vegas looking, hurls herself at the casket and says, "Who did this to you, Sonny? You know, tell me what happened, Sonny." And, you know, I think she knew.
You think she knew,
what happened to him. Yeah.
There were so many questions around Geraldine's behavior after his death.
Yeah. One of the theories in the book is that, you know, Geraldine comes home after a vacation with her family in St. Louis and hadn't heard from Sonny in days. Why would she have stayed away? Well, you know, Sonny was partial to his benders, and it's not impossible she would have come home and seen strippers, you know, draped over the furniture. In this case, she didn't hear from him. She comes home, follows the smell of rotting flesh up to the bedroom, sees him slumped over, and runs away to a friend's house, comes back. They're alone in that house for something like 3 hours, presumably cleaning it up. The feds thought that Sonny had kept all of the drugs that he sold in an outdoor fireplace with a loose brick. Anyway, by the time the police are finally called, they find a balloon of heroin on the table. Why would Geraldine have left that there if she had just cleaned the house up? So I argue that it was because the cops planted it, but I also argue that Geraldine didn't want to help the cops because she knew something, and it was just all part of the layers and layers and layers of secrets that lay behind the heavyweight champion's murder.
Do you think she might have actually had something to do with his death?
I think she might have had something to do with covering it up. I don't know that she stayed away knowing that somebody was going to murder her husband. I think she really loved her husband. I think she might have lived out her years scared that if she said something, something might happen to her. And there are these, I mean, Geraldine, if you look at the photos in the 50s and 60s where Sonny is the angriest black man in America, I mean, really at a polarizing time when the civil rights movement is beginning, Sonny is the last person that black America wants to represent them. He's surly and churlish, and his eyes just, you know, look like bullets. And Geraldine was always the soft person around him.
And that wasn't a deliberate sound effect. That was us heading out to break. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. It's a conversation with award-winning investigative reporter Sean Assale about his book, The Murder of Sonny Liston, Las Vegas Heroin and Heavyweights. When we come back from this break, more from the book. We'll hear about Lennon Lacy, the teenager from Bladenboro. You can call us on this Wednesday by sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. Or call us at 910-343-1138. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Sean Assale is an award-winning investigative reporter. He worked for ESPN for 20 years. He's the author of 4 books, the most recent published in 2016, and now the subject of a Showtime documentary called The Murder of Sonny Liston, Las Vegas Heroin and Heavyweights. Sean Assale is also a local. He lives here with his wife and 2 dachshunds, and he's answering your questions on this Wednesday. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. You write about your wife in the acknowledgments of this book, and you talked about how her research helped to drive this book project. Was there ever a point that she got worried about your physical safety as you investigated what you needed to for this book?
No, that ship has long since sailed. No, she's, matter of fact, she's happy when I'm out of the house. So the last thing she's worried about is that. But no, what was wonderful was having somebody who could help me immerse myself in the granular detail of that era and being able to talk about it. And I mean, it was indispensable. It was in that respect, a joint project.
You talked about Sonny Liston's first round, would you call it a surrender to Muhammad Ali in 1965, possibly playing into the circumstances surrounding his death. Can you kind of take that apart for us, that question around his loss to Ali?
Sure. If you're a boxing fan, you'll remember the 2 fights. The first is in 1964. It goes 7 rounds, and Sonny does a no mas. It shocks the world. The reason is that Ali is a loose-limbed upstart from Louisville, who everybody thinks is a clown. Nobody thinks Ali is for real. Even though he was an Olympic gold medalist, Sonny certainly didn't. The second Sonny's in the round with Ali in the first fight, he realizes he's fast and he has an exceedingly long reach. And so Sonny starts to worry. He doesn't expect the fight's going to go seven rounds. By the time it does, he quits. By the time of the second fight, Sonny is a pariah for having quit. We talked about how, you know, he seemed to have besmirched the honor of the heavyweight champions that Lewis and Patterson had built. So the only place that'll take him is a Lewiston, Maine, a small place with a rinky-dink hockey rink. And in Lewiston, Sonny goes down and whatever it is, the first 20 seconds, it's the most iconic photo in the 20th century. Ali's standing over him. What Ali is saying is, get up, sucker. What Sonny is doing is laying there with his arms kind of in a triangle behind his head, woozily, massaging the canvas. That he went down so fast was a shock to almost everyone except the mob, who had all sorts of reasons to know that Sonny wasn't ready for that fight and that the long odds on Ali were going to make a lot of people a lot of money. The idea that's been floated that I find persuasive, because it was something that was not uncommon in boxing, is that Sonny would have struck a deal, if not with Ali, with Ali's people, to get a cut of his future earnings to go down. Ali had yet to protest the draft in such a way that he'd be banned from boxing because of his beliefs. Ali looked like a good bet going forward, so that for Sonny to have accepted a piece of Ali's future earnings looked good then. It didn't look good again until 1969, when Ali was coming back and scheduled to make $5 million against Joe Frazier. That was money that Sonny, at the time, gorging on heroin, gorging on cocaine, gorging on Las Vegas and hookers and all the rest that came with it. He could have used that money. And as I said earlier, there were a lot of people, including, it was widely rumored, his former manager, a casino executive by the name of Ash Resnick, who would have had plenty reasons to want to see Sonny silenced.
So is there any reason to believe that Ali just landed a punch that really laid Sonny Liston out and ended the fight? I mean, is that credible to anyone?
Yeah, there are those that thought, I think Jimmy Breslin famously, that it was a bone-crushing punch. But Sonny could take a punch. And the way Sonny went down looked particularly theatrical, and it was just a time in his life where, he was thinking like a mobster, and mobsters think about the long-term payday, not the short-term win. So I find it persuasive that that Sonny took a dive, and he later alluded to that in such a way. And look, I've also in the book spoke to somebody who hadn't spoken for 40 years about the fact that he was sitting around drinking with Sonny in a shopping mall in Las Vegas in 1969, where Sonny admitted to having a piece of Ali's future earnings.
Did Sonny Liston ever see any of those earnings?
No. Sonny died. Sonny died hustling coke at the International Hotel and taking, two-bit paydays, like a $13,000 payday to go to the Armory in Jersey City to fight Chuck Wepner. So, no. I mean, Sonny, as somebody famously said, was cut up pretty well, meaning his contract was sold so many times over and over again, he didn't have much to see at the end.
And so what impact do you think that fight had on the rest of Sonny Liston's career as a boxer?
Well, I mean, Sonny was never the same after that, right? I mean, he's banned from boxing for 3 years. He can't get a fight, has to go to Sweden to fight. And then by the time he makes his comeback, he's seen as it's funny how quickly the civil rights era kind of receded into the flower power late 60s. Sonny is now seen as a kind of more iconic figure. He's on the cover of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. The Monkees put him in a movie. And so Sonny is kind of, even apart from boxing, I say right in the book, kind of was the original gangster, the OG, somebody who the pop culture had caught up with, and he loved that. I mean, he would sit at the kino machines at the International Hotel, and people would come up to him and they'd say, you're Sonny Liston, and he'd go, yeah, I know that. So he was still surly to the end. He had he pre-printed his business card with his signature on it because he couldn't, he hated to sign his own name. But, he was in some respects happy for the first time in his life in those years.
You're listening to Coastline today. It's a conversation with Sean Assale, investigative reporter. Worked for ESPN for 20 years, he's the author of four books, including his most recent, The Murder of Sonny Liston, Las Vegas, Heroin, and Heavyweights. You can ask Sean Assayle your own question on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138 or emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. Sean Assayle, the picture that you paint of Las Vegas in the 1960s is pretty bleak. Everyone seems directly or tangentially sullied by crime. You even point to Wilt Chamberlain's likely involvement with the mob. You say that there might have been a story engineered to make his team, the 76ers, I think, underdogs, and then suddenly they weren't. What happened in that game? Leading up to the game.
Wow. So Wilt was palling around with Sonny's manager, Ash Resnick, and there was a he had gone out of a game. You're killing me here. In I think New York with a bad knee. The next night he was supposed to not to play. The long money was on. I think it was at that point the money was on the St. Louis Hawks, and I think his 76ers were long shots. And then Wilt suddenly comes back and
his knee's okay.
His knee is suddenly fine. And then, you know, Ash Resnick was there along with Joe Louis. And I think Sinatra was there that night. So, you know, there was a suggestion that you know, Ash had more friends than just Sonny and Joe. And Wilt was one of them. And later in the late 60s when he was in L.A., he was a Laker. He was a famous guest at the Caesars with Ash. So, you know, that's Vegas at that time. I mean, was everybody sullied by crime? I mean, I don't think they would look at it that way. I just think it was like the way business was conducted.
But then you talk about how in this, when you're talking about the rivalry between Kirk Kerkorian and Howard Hughes in Las Vegas, there's this interesting regulatory requirement that up to that point had prevented major hotel chains from investing in Las Vegas because they had to do board of directors or major stockholder background checks, and no one was willing to subject their major stockholders or boards to that kind of investigation. And then that got lifted when they realized they would be thwarting Kirk Kerkorian's plans for the Strip. So how was that regulatory requirement effective if the mob basically still ran Vegas?
Right. So, you know, you had name brands like Hilton, the Hilton chain coming in, and you know, that was cleaning up a lot of the decrepit parts of the Strip. But look, I mean, they just laundered the money through the Jimmy Hoffa's Teamsters and the pension funds. I mean, the mob just figured out other ways of laundering their money. What that did is it gave Vegas, you know, its cake and it ate it too. So Baron Hilton finally decides, all right, you know, now I'll come in. And then they, you know, the Hilton brand was a big name. But it didn't, you know, it didn't slow the mob down, not at all. And by the way, Howard Hughes was still in his penthouse in the I think it was the Frontier Hotel, and he was still calling a lot of the shots. He hated Kerkorian. You know, they had a rivalry to end all rivalries, and Kerkorian went bankrupt and rebuilt himself, and that's what you could do in Vegas, and that's what's so great about that town. It just tore itself down and rebuilt itself, and to this day, it's one of the most remarkable things about Sin City.
You've talked about Muhammad Ali facing charges for refusing to comply with the draft, and so while he's unable to box, he's going around and lecturing on college campuses, and he talks about religious pacifism. You write about his stint in a Broadway musical, and you report that he told a journalist for the magazine, The Black Scholar, quote, "I'm supposed to be walking around somewhere broke, but I surprised them. I'm doing better. I'm not depending on the white power structure and the boxing game for survival. Fighters are just brutes that come to entertain the rich, beat up on each other and break each other's noses, show off like two little monkeys for the crowd, killing each other for the crowd. And half of the crowd is white. We're slaves in that ring." He eventually goes back to boxing when he can. But is that a fair assessment of the sport? Was there
no? I mean, look. It's, you know, what Ali was going through isn't unlike what Colin Kaepernick is going through now. You know, there's both elements of political conscience that left each exiled from their sports. You know, what Ali was doing, though, was really trying to have his cake and eat it, too, right? He was parroting Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam because he was still very much in the thralls of that his nascent, that nascent Islam. By the same token, he was hurting for money, and he wanted his managers to get him any fight he could, and he was trying to get – there were all sorts of fights that he tried to create that fell apart because nobody wanted him. He was such a polarizing figure. That particular passage was catching Ali at a time in his life where he was struggling between, you know, the man who wanted it all and the man who wanted it, you know, to also present himself as a good Muslim. So it was – Ali was a canny figure, and I think that was a canny interview.
And of course, you've also talked about the fact that the age issue with Sonny Liston is confusing. We don't really know how old he was when he died. The Sun writes about Charles Sonny Liston, 38, may have died from an overdose of heroin. And he also, John Sutton, undercover cop who'd been working to bring Sonny in as an informant, said he'd seen Sonny less than a month before his death, and the champ looked fine. He said, better than fine, fantastic for someone close to 50. How is 38 close to 50, and why such a wide-ranging disparity in guessing at his age?
Right, because, you know, as I said, Sonny never he was born in Forest City, Arkansas, without a birth certificate. His father was a sharecropper. He had, I think it was 14 kids. And, and Sonny lived his life not knowing how old he was. When he was fighting in the Golden Globes and a manager needed to put a birth date down, they just guessed. They just pulled something out of the air. And, look, Sonny hated being teased about his age. He hated what was obvious, right? So much about him was obvious, and he couldn't control that. And so, it churned inside him. It was one of the things that churned. But, anybody who underestimated him, even to the end, was risking themselves. I mean, Chuck Wepner, when by the time he faces Sonny in his last fight, realizes he's thought he had trained the hardest he had ever trained. Sonny takes off his shirt. His body was 15 years younger than his face. And Wepner suddenly has this sickening realization that he doesn't think he's trained hard enough. And sure enough, you know, Wepner gets beat up so badly, he needs to be in an ice bath for 3 days. He leaves that fight with a temperature of 108. Sonny was still a killing machine. And, his last fight was, the fight where he thought he was going to get a title fight with Joe Frazier ends badly. He loses, but he detaches the retina of his opponent in the course of losing. So, I mean, that jab he had, it wasn't at the end of his life what it was when he was rising as a killing machine, but it was formidable enough that George Foreman copied it and, you know, came up as the baby Sonny, and there's just a lot of people, boxing purists, who will say that that's just the best jab that ever was.
You've laid out maybe half a dozen different interests, people who might have wanted Sonny Liston dead. You, in your investigation, eventually find this guy, Larry Gandy. You talked about an envelope. Tell us about the envelope, how that came to you.
Yeah, so two-thirds of the way through the book, and I'm pretty well good with my game of Clue. I've got Mr. Mustard in the living room. I've got, Miss Peacock, whatever the character. So I have my characters, but I don't yet have sort of a definitive ending. The transcript that comes to me is a transcript that a Las Vegas police snitch named Irwin Peters gave in 1983 after a relationship he had with a hero cop turned bad. The hero cop broke bad, started dealing cocaine, ripping off the drug dealers he had once put to jail. This snitch was working with the hero cop, and the snitch begins to think that the hero cop is now going to kill him. He goes to the police station, and he says, I want to turn him in. The cops are debriefing him, and among the other things he says is, and by the way, this hero cop killed Sonny Liston. It's all in the transcript. I had not seen that in any great detail before, and so I'm like, Lord, what do I do with this?
Who mailed you the transcript?
Well, it was unmarked.
Who do you think sent it to you?
Well, I know who sent it to me. So, really, Rachel.
Just doing
nice
my
try.
Job.
Nice try, but really, you got to do better than that. So I look to see if this hero cop is still around. And, of course, I employ my great investigative technique. I look on Facebook, and there he is. And, you know, he still looks like, at age 70-something, a guy I don't want to mess with. So I'm wondering what to do. And I just decide to email him. And I do. And he emails me right back. And he says, I'd love to meet with you. And I go to Vegas, and there's a reason. I call the chapter about him suspect number one. I knock on his door. He throws around me his arms around me. And as I write in the book, he looks like Santa Claus in the off-season. And the first words out of his mouth are, so I guess you're here to ask me if I killed Sonny Liston. And I was. And he spent the next 4 hours explaining to me why he didn't, why he thinks others did. In the course of that, he also explained to me why dead bodies seem to gather around him. And it was one of the most remarkable four-hour interviews I've ever done. And to this day, we remain friendly. To this day, he insists he didn't kill Sonny. And to this day, there are people who still think that, there may be things he knows. Most troubling is that the police snitch ended up dead not long after giving that interview to the cops. And there are some people that think that,
And the police snitch also got menacing postcards, anonymous postcards saying, "You're going to wind up here," with a picture of the desert.
Yeah, it was. Those are some edgy times, Rachel. Those are some edgy times.
The law enforcement culture that you uncover in this era is pretty shocking. How widespread was that crossover between police, sheriff's deputies, and criminal behavior? And were there a lot of dirty cops?
If the question is, were there a lot of dirty cops? The answer is, oh, yeah. It was just wide open. It was a wide open town. I mean, you didn't have police review commissions. You know, you just, as somebody once told me, their orders were go to the bus station, pick up these people and leave them in the desert and just, kick them out of town. So it was a rough and ready town.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. Sean Assayle's most recent book, The Murder of Sonny Liston, Las Vegas, Heroin and Heavyweights, is being made into a Showtime documentary. You can call us on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org with your own question. When we come back from this short break, we'll have one more segment for you to get that in. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Sean Assayle, award-winning investigative reporter, worked for ESPN for 20 years. He's the author of 4 books, including The Murder of Sonny Liston. He's also investigated the 2014 death of Bladenboro teenager Lennon Lacey, and he has looked into the role the United Daughters of the Confederacy play in monument preservation in North Carolina. And he's answering your questions on this Wednesday. You can reach us today at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. It's the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question in. Lennon Lacey, 17-year-old football player in Bladenboro, which is a small rural town in southeastern North Carolina, is found dead in 2014, hanging from a swing set. Local officials say the death is a suicide. Did you doubt that conclusion, Sean Assayle?
The NAACP doubted the conclusion, and that was enough for me. I mean, when ESPN made the decision that they wanted to cover that story, I thought a courageous decision, and they sent me down. We didn't know what we would find, and we kept getting chased out of the town because nobody really wanted us there, and they didn't want us to find whatever there was to find. The family had questions. That was enough for us, and what we found was not what we thought we were going to go in to find.
What did you find?
Well, the idea that the initial narrative was that this was a hate crime that was the result of a young man going out with an older young African-American man, high school student going out with an older Caucasian woman. It was a scandal in the town, and that shades of the darkest days of the 1940s and 50s, he was made to pay for that by being killed in a public square in the most sort of visible way possible. That narrative quickly fell apart. especially because the sort of young love romance that supposedly occurred wasn't that at all. He may have thought that he was in love. The woman that he thought he was in love with, it turned out, had a habit of entertaining many, many men, perhaps for profit.
Was she a prostitute?
Entertaining many, many men, perhaps for profit, and also had a fairly widely known drug habit. And so what wound up—
And he was aware of that. He'd witnessed men going in and out of her place.
One of the things that we discovered was that on the night of his death, he had witnessed a man going into her home, a man that we later found had a fairly extensive criminal record, including including violent crimes. But there were other people around him. What emerged is a Southern Gothic, where it was less about race and more about poverty and more about the lengths people would go to for very, very small pieces just for small things. I mean, did he die at his own hand or somebody else's? It was really hard to see how he could have died at his own hand, lifting himself on a swing set, tying his own noose, and there were— the family had all sorts of forensic analyses done, along with the Southern Poverty Law Center and some others who pitched in to help, the NAACP. At the end of the day, the family just wanted some questions answered, and we tried to help them.
The Justice Department issued its report in 2016, 2 years after Lennon Lacy's death, and Lennon Lacy's family was shown evidence that wasn't available to the public, that supposedly showed the death was not necessarily a homicide. Do you know what that evidence was?
I do not know what all of it was. Some of it had to do with shoes that weren't his, and where did his shoes go? Some of it had to do with alternate forensics. And I know that we just finished speaking about Sonny Liston, and I told you that people thought he was it was natural causes. I think it's murder. I don't want to come off as like sort of like the crank conspiracist here. But to this day, I just don't see how the Justice Department can have been so conclusive. There was half of what they found, which I can understand, which is that it didn't appear to be the victim of a hate crime, meaning that race wasn't necessarily involved, and I could see that. But there were other things even that we learned that we didn't put in our piece, which you can see on my website. It's seanassail.com. That leads me to believe that I'm just unclear how they could be so certain foul play was ruled out. But they did appear to be certain, and I suppose I have to, we have to leave it at that.
Can you explain the shoe question, though? Because as you said, he was found hanging with shoes that did not have laces, and they were too small for they weren't his shoes, clearly. They didn't fit. And he had Air Jordans that were gone. Does anyone have an answer for that?
Yes. It just winds up, and I'm not going to do it here because it's a rabbit hole, but there was a constellation of characters here, right? I mean, and this is, if you just put your mindset in the small little hive of homes that are all clustered and not much more than a football field, right? And they're all right on top of each other, and it's a hothouse of everybody knowing everybody else's business and people sort of staying with each other and rotating ways because they're getting thrown out of their homes and their welfare checks are stopping, and it's all this just sort of swirl of Southern, of Southern Gothic poverty. And so, everybody has something on somebody, and that's what made this story so tragic. And Lennon, he was called a local football star. He wasn't. He was, about to play in his first game, but he was a happy-go-lucky kid, and he just got burned in the hothouse. And whether or not it was murder or otherwise, that story just contains so many lessons, I think, for how hard it is to grow up in some of these communities and remain untouched by, in the social media age, just what, how easy it is to just get caught up in it.
Have you stayed in touch with Lennon Lacy's family?
They've changed some phone numbers. I've tried. I've let them know that, you know, I'm thinking about her. Claudia especially struck me as a very, very prez mother, a proud woman who just wanted to get to the truth. And I left that experience having so much respect for her. And she's apparently now at peace with the Justice Department's findings. But to, you know, to lose a son by waking up one morning and seeing him hanging in a public square, it just does summon so much of an awful past.
But you're saying that she has accepted the idea that this was suicide.
I think she's accepted the fact that law enforcement has looked into this and concluded that there's no evidence of homicide. I'm not sure that's the same as saying she's accepted it's a suicide.
Fair enough. You write about Confederate monuments for Glamour magazine, and this was just last month.
No, I think it's still in the current issue. It's still on sale.
Okay. You title your article, "The Secret Fight to Save Confederate Monuments," positing the notion that this band of sweet white grandmas is doing more to save these symbols of white supremacy than any mob of skinheads could possibly do. Tell us why you say that. What are they doing to help preserve Confederate memorials in public places?
Right. So assuming that we all sort of have a general knowledge of what the United Daughters of the Confederacy are, right, this group that was founded in the late 1800s to build monuments, to grieve for the war dead. Every family in the South had lost one or more members, and there were places where they needed to grieve. The daughters come around collecting nickels and dimes to start building these monuments. At some point, in the early 1900s through the 30s, they go into hyperdrive, and the monuments they built weren't necessarily stone obelisks and cemeteries. They were explicit wartime monuments put in the heart of public squares. We see it here in Wilmington. We see it in Birmingham, Alabama. So the raison d'etre of the daughters are these monuments. And the monuments were explicitly built to carry their narrative and their narrative of loss, their narrative of what the blood and soil they gave up meant to them, right? Fair enough to a point, because at some point that narrative then begins to swamp other narratives, right? The civil rights movement, so that the Jim Crow laws, these monuments begin to look like intimidating, answers to a progressive movement. The story that I wrote is about the daughters today, because many people think that they've just sort of become this vestigial group of easy to caricature grandmothers with Kentucky Derby hats and old sashes. And what I found was that I think that they have a remarkable soft power. I think that they're an extremely effective political action committee. I think that their links in state houses around the South remain strong. And I think, as I write, in places like Texas, where there's now a law that says that slavery has to be the third thing, that the third cause of the Civil War that's taught in schools besides states' rights and secession, suggests that the daughters, these grandmothers who call themselves educators or refer to themselves as educators, are very much involved in retaining a narrative that has become polarizing, and they're not really giving up an inch.
You spoke with Peggy Johnson, who runs the UDC's North Carolina division, and she argues that anyone who sees these monuments or memorials as symbols of white supremacy, quote, lacks education and has no interest in history. She says they were never put there to intimidate anyone. As you say, they were put there for grieving mourners. Is that the truth, do you think, of what she believes?
Well, I can't say whether what she believes is true to her or not. I mean, even Peggy Johnson will acknowledge, right, that some of the early material that the daughters handed out would, by today's standards, be considered wildly racist and inappropriate. You know, the reason that this is such a polarizing debate is that when you use a term like education, it becomes a euphemism, right? It just, what is education in everybody's eyes is different. My story goes behind the Silent Sam controversy that we're having, and it reports, I think for the first time, that Peggy Johnson, president of the United Daughters, sat down with one of the protesters, and they tried to have they had a dinner. It was an off-the-record dinner. It was at a Cracker Barrel, of all places. And here were these two sides in an otherwise incredibly polarizing debate trying to find common ground. And they just, as polite as it was and as decent as it was, they just talked past one another. And I think I do struggle with whether there is a resolution for groups like the Daughters that believe that their narrative should be the prevailing one, and other people who just find the narrative offensive. It's a hard middle ground to eke out.
You say that they have links in state government. How specifically does their power show up? What kind of links do they have? How do they influence policymakers?
Right. So in the magazine that the Daughters put out, you constantly see photos of them in group poses with politicians or in front of state houses or shaking hands. And I think the Daughters' position on this is a little bit like an NRA position or a that it's a litmus test issue. And if you want, I don't so much think it's if you want the Daughters behind you. I think it's if you don't want them against you.
Why? Why is it so scary to have the UDC against you?
Because, there's certain, first of all, women of a certain age, and this is just simply empirical vote, right? They're high salience voters. They go out, they get to the polls, it matters, right? So that's a group that you want to turn out in close elections, right? I think the Daughters, along with their corollaries, the Sons of Confederate Veterans, but I think the Daughters specifically, given their matriarchal positions, can turn out voters. I think it's as simple as that. I think they remain a powerful pack because they can turn out voters.
They're also generally an older group, as you say. So are their ranks shrinking?
Their ranks are shrinking. At their height, they had 100,000 members. Now I think the number is something like 14,000, 15,000. But they, as they told me, and it was funny, when I went to start reporting this piece, I was told, oh, they'll never talk to you. And yet I didn't have a problem getting a single daughter I wanted to talk to on the phone. And I think part of it is that and it was expressed to me that they find a new generation of people who quote unquote want to have their voices heard. And I wonder if that's not a reflection of sort of the Trump era and a sort of a new emboldenedness to saying certain things that may not have been acceptable in polite company before.
So they can help turn out a contingent when it comes to getting out the vote. Why else do some policymakers find the UDC so intimidating? What are the other reasons?
Well, nobody wants a kindly grandmother showing up on your doorstep saying that you're unraveling the American way. I mean, they have what they do down, and they have it down well.
Two members of the State Historical Commission were with us just a week or so ago, and they talked about being threatened by lawsuits if they didn't find. If they did anything to relocate or remove those Confederate memorials on the Capitol grounds.
Yeah, so the Daughters, right. So the Daughters are the sort of matriarchic face of a movement that is also fueled by the Sons. The Sons have a much deeper legal bench. The Sons have their own defense fund. The Sons have attorneys on call, and the Sons are often quick to turn to the courts, what they call heritage battles. What the Sons will often do in this sort of heritage fringe is finance suits on behalf of the Daughters because the Daughters present a more appealing plaintiff. So in a case like in, I think it's Caddo Parish, where the parish commission wants to take down a monument, the Daughters are suing, but they're suing with a Son's attorney. So they've got their methods down, and I think you'd be foolish to dismiss them as has-beens. I mean, they've adapted fairly sophisticatedly to the current climate.
You're a relatively new local. You moved here about 2 years ago, and we have two Confederate statues at the entrance to downtown. Thoughts? in 10 seconds or less.
Wow. I don't know. I can't quite get my head around that yet.
That's this edition of Coastline. Sean Assale, what a pleasure having you with us today. Thank you.
You're the best, Rachel. Thank you.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Production manager, Caitlin Hanrahan. Caitlin Freund is our webmaster. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Get the podcast, find it on the HQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 3. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.